Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Lee Boyce. And coming up, savings plans to help strengthen our financial resilience. But are they any good? New tipping rules might have come into force, but what is tronk? And, well, Lee's fed up with all the guilt-tripping over tips, and he calls himself the optional service charge hater. Also today, can my parents become our mortgage lender so we can upsize and haggle a cash discount? And are mortgage rates set to now rise? Plus, Lee's collecting corner, a Pokemon card, the Salmon 50p and 1980s NatWest piggy banks. But how much are they worth? Don't forget you stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, all workers should be auto-enrolled into a £1,000 rainy day fund in addition to their pensions under two separate but similar proposals floated by the Resolution Foundation and Schroders and the Pension Management Institute. Now, to achieve this, both propose a hike in minimum pension contributions and once you've hit £1,000, any surplus could be diverted into your retirement pot. There are also elements to allow people to borrow money from their pension pot should they suffer severe financial shocks and to access funds to buy a first home. Well, Simon spoke to Schroders head of UK public policy, Rich Fox, to find out more about its plan. But before we hear from Rich, Simon, what problem, just outline for us if you would, what problem are both of these plans and proposals trying to address?
I think that both of these proposals are quite interesting. And I think they're quite interesting because they're trying to address something that's not going to be a problem for most of the people listening to this podcast. And it's not going to be a problem for most of the people who come and read This Is Money regularly. What they are trying to address is financial resilience and a lack of savings, first of all, in which there are many, many people in the country who have no savings at all. And there was an FCA estimate, I think it was an FCA report a while back, that said 34% of people don't have £1,000 in savings. So they have it either under, you know, nothing or up to £1,000. And actually Schroders, when I spoke to Rich, you know, they said that in their research, it was higher, it was 40-something percent. And if you look at the statistics from, you know, debt charities and such, they say that just having £1,000 makes a massive difference to if you have a financial problem, whether it then becomes a severe financial problem that's going to affect you for years to come, whether you can ride it out, basically. So it's trying to address that financial resilience problem, first of all, but then also to address another couple of issues that we have, which is the increasing challenge of owning a home. So it's all very well coming from the perspective of, well, I've got a rainy day pot and I had to save it up myself and I've got a home and I had to save hard to raise a deposit. But the reality is lots of people don't have rainy day pots and lots of people look at the opportunity for buying a home and it goes way beyond them. And also the problem with that is then that it's going to be much more expensive for you in retirement if you're renting. It's not to say owning a home is the only way forwards, but if you come to retirement and you don't own a home outright, you're going to have to continue paying rent. So you're going to need a much bigger pension pot. And then also the lack of adequate savings for retirement. Now, auto enrollment has done an awful lot to get more people saving for retirement. There is a big gap there, which is the self-employed, which I think is something that needs to be addressed. And we've talked about lots more, but more money needs to be going into people's pension pots. And effectively what this is doing is coming up with an idea. And interestingly, you've got these two very similar ideas, but they're totally separate. There was no plan to release these at the same time. It's a kind of, you know, new government thing, new ideas, new government, new thoughts, that kind of thing. But they're trying to build on the success of auto enrollment, which, you know, although probably more money does need to be going into people's pensions, it does mean that there has been a big uptick in the number of people saving for retirement and also saving for retirement from a young age, which is a really important thing. So to find out a bit more about this, as you said, I spoke to Rich Fox, Schroder's head of UK public policy, and he explained from the horse's mouth a little bit more about what their plan is.
So we put out a report with the Pensions Management Institute this week that sets out all the detail. But at its heart, it's two things. So the first thing is about short-term savings. When you join a new job, your employer already has to enroll you into a pension, start making contributions. What we're suggesting is alongside that, they make it quite easy. So kind of click of a button to also put a little bit of your pay into a short-term savings account. And then if you did that, it would start happening for you in the background. So the idea is to make it easy. But why is that important? It's because we all know we need to save. Loads of people just don't have even a basic rainy day savings fund. So little shocks can knock their finances off course. So we think this approach, where it would make it quite easy to do that, would just help a lot more people build up a basic savings buffer. The longer term bit is introducing a bit of flexibility to pensions, because we looked around the world and actually the UK's got one of the most inflexible pension systems of the ones we looked at. So we are basically saying we'd like the government to change the rules to let you access some, not all, but some of your pension early for two reasons. One, help you with a deposit to that first time home, because that transforms your finances in retirement. And secondly, if you get into really problematic debt, we don't think it makes a lot of sense to have this money sitting there, but you can't touch it. So again, if you were in really serious debt, we're saying you'd be allowed to get some of your pension early to help you with that problem.
And I was interested when I read the report, because I think that there's a couple of things in there where it seems to be these are many of these things we've tried before, but all separately, not together. And secondly, it touches on a few things that we're often a little bit nervous about, which is the defaulting people into doing something, which was the concern about auto-enrollment, but that has been a success. And also the letting them access those savings that bit early. So why do you think we need this plan, and would it make a real difference to people?
Step change tell us that if a household has £1,000, transforms their financial resilience, you're 54% more likely to ride out shocks without it wrecking your finances. But sadly, 46% of people don't have that £1,000. 16% have nothing. So we need to get people saving, and we hope this makes it easy. And then for the house buying one, which I think is particularly controversial, and I should say, look, we all know we need to build more houses. And the government is onto that. They're looking at planning. They're looking to make those changes. So why did we look at early access for housing? Well, the number of people renting in retirement is estimated to triple in the next 20 years. And it's not just about sort of my home is my castle. It's not about that. It's financial. So as the government looks at building more houses, we think you can look at pensions a bit more smartly to help people get on that first rung of the ladder, because we just think that's so important.
If we've established it's a good idea, we need to help people with their financial resilience. It helps to cut the cost of the housing in retirement, and also encourages people to save more for retirement, because saving is a habit. How difficult would it be to get this off the ground, do you think?
Also, you've made a really good point on that last point. Actually, what does this do? It turns your pension from something that is like tomorrow you's problem into something that you care about today. So I really agree with you there. And how hard would it be? I think this would be in phases. So on the short-term savings part, actually, you can get going with a version of this right now if you want to. As an employer, you need to talk to your pension provider. Indeed, we know some big employers, you would have heard of the kind of high street names, who are doing a version of this now. What we think the government can do is make it easier to do it. There's sort of some tricky bits in law that they can sweep away to make it easier. On the pension side, now that does need the government to act, because right now you just can't access that money early. So that would need legislative change to enable that. But that's why we're really pleased that we think it's a great time to be having this debate, because we have a pensions review. We have a pensions bill coming along. So we want our proposals, the PMI and us want this to be a big contribution to this debate, because the government is looking at this and they could do this if they decided it was a good idea.
Well, that was Schroder's head of UK public policy, Rich Fox, talking to Simon Lee. All these ideas, these plans, the one from the Resolution Foundation, what do you make of them all? I mean, Clearly, there's a need to strengthen our financial resilience. Will they work?
Well, on the face of it, you think actually they're not the daftest ideas you've ever heard of. No, but the thing is, it is very difficult for people to get into that habit, as we've spoken about on this podcast many times in the past, into that savings habit of it doesn't need to be huge sums of money getting put into a separate pot. You know, it can be a real trickle, a monthly direct debit, you know, as I've always hopped on, I always like the regular savers because, you know, it gets you in the habit and it helps you with any kind of financial shockwaves that you might have over the course of the year. And let's face it, there's lots of financial shockwaves that we can have, from car breaking down or failing an MOT to a boiler problem to all sorts of things can go wrong. And you'd much rather be in a position where you could tap into some savings rather than having to rely on debt or having to eat into your monthly salary. So I think that any idea like this, it's worth a thought. It's worth thinking if, okay, you're putting auto-enrollment, you're between you and your workplace, you're putting 8% of your salary each month into a pension. If that nudges up to 10% and 2% of that's used to put in a savings pot to build up a savings buffer for you that you can access, because crucially, auto-enrollment, for all of the great that it appears to be doing, you cannot access that money until you're at retirement age. So it's not going to help you with those financial shockwaves. So if you have managed to build up a 4, 5, 6-figure pension pot through auto-enrollment, the fruits of that are not going to come true for, you know, many decades. Whereas if you've got this on hand and a pot of cash that's going to get you into that habit and give you that financial confidence, I think it's good. And actually, in this Resolution Foundation report, I was having a look through it, and I thought this was quite interesting. It said that the combination of auto-enrollment and the new state pension means median earners who make £37,000 in the financial year 2024-25 now manage to replace at least 45% of their salary at retirement. That was the minimum replacement target for retirement income proposed by the Official Pension Commission 2 decades ago. But the commission wanted people to achieve a higher replacement target of 80% of wages for low earners, 67% for middle earners, and 50% for the high earners. Now, the kicker in this here is that resolutions say fully auto-enrolled low earners are on track to hit their target replacement rates upon retirement. So that's great news. So, mm-hmm. You know, there is that argument that lots of people haven't saved properly for their retirement in a kind of previous generation and are heavily reliant on the state pension. And we don't fully know what the future of the state pension is really going to look like in 20, 30, 40 years time. But on the other hand, middle and high earners are some way off track. So bringing in probably more of our readership and listenership that are probably more likely to be middle or high earners, you might be thinking, well, I'm fine, you know, I'm also enrolled in my private pension, I'm saving enough. But actually, this report suggests, and the data that it's picked up on, is that that's not necessarily true. So also enrollment, for all the good it's done, there is still some element of your own personal responsibility, whether it is your pension and making sure that you are using targets and forecasts to have a rich enough retirement, and also if the whole element of savings, you know, and there is an onus at the moment on you to go, do you know what, things are tight, we've come out the back of a cost of living crisis. Everything's got more expensive. You might be facing higher mortgage costs, higher rents, all of that kind of thing. But if you can just eke out a small amount each month, it might not feel like much at the beginning. It's like a little snowball. And then you add a little bit more and a little bit more and it goes downhill and it gets into something bigger. That's the kind of habit you need to get into. Yes, you might need to dip into it from time to time to cover something. Or maybe you just turn around and say, I don't actually want to touch this money. I'm just going to build this up as my kind of buffer. Yes, I'm auto enrolled, my pension's growing, but I have a real lack of a financial savings buffer. If there's anything we can do that helps, you know, I'm never keen on meddling, especially meddling in financial affairs, but if it helps people get into that savings habit, I think it can only be a good thing.
I just worry about, and not to poo-poo this idea, because I think that having a savings scheme along with your work could be really valuable. But surely the people that are struggling the most will not be able to find those extra couple of percentage. I mean, I assume increasing your percentage from currently 8%, which is obviously shared by yourself 5% and the employer 3%, The extra 2% to take it up to 10% would come from what, you, or would it come from your employer? Because if it comes from you, those people, like I say, who are struggling the most, would that not increase the number of people who are choosing to opt out? And then it could have disastrous consequences for their future.
This is one of the concerns about raising the pension auto-enrollment amounts to a level that is judged to be the level that we should be at, is that more people will opt out. Now, I will start by saying that I think the employer contribution should be raised. I think that at the moment you pay in 5% as an individual and your employer pays in 3%. I think the employer should be matching it. Employers will grumble about this. It's a cost to them. It's cheaper than the final salary pensions that they used to give people. I think that, you know, they should be matching it. If you go back to what you said, yes, actually, in some of the report, for example, in the Schroeder's report, it talks about an extra 6% coming in from the employee. Now, if you suddenly whacked up auto enrollment by 6%, you would definitely see a load more people opt out because it would be a more meaningful sum of money. But the evidence that we have seen from auto enrollment is that people don't opt out, and that, you know, and at the moment that's 5%. You know, there was concern when it went up to 5% that it would increase opt-outs. So I do think there is the opportunity to push it up more. And I think there's the opportunity to push it up more if you've got something like a short-term goal in sight, this financial resilience pot, this £1,000 pot. Now, what would be the cost of that to you? Okay, so they, interestingly, and what I like here is that in the Schroeder's report, they talk about this, is they have said they are targeting the people who can save some money. You know, even if it's a little bit, it's some money, but also that they've looked at what would benefit people, you know, who are below a high earning level. So they've used £60,000 a year. They've said, obviously, this would benefit people above that, but those people don't need the help. They're trying to look at the people that they've identified as needing the help. And they've used a starting salary of £25,000, which is a quite realistic starting salary. They haven't started, you know, at mid-30s median earnings, because most people don't start at mid-30s median earnings. Most people build up to median earnings. And if you were on £25,000 a year, the extra 2% going into that financial resilience pot would be £30 a month. And that would mean it would take you 34 months to reach your £1,000 pot. It's a long time to get to your £1,000 pot. But if the alternative is that you just spent 34 months and then you still had no savings at the end of it anyway, because you hadn't been putting the money aside, then it's clearly a better option to be doing the former. Now, what I'd like to see would be that if this came in, or you could do this voluntarily, employers could organise this stuff themselves if they wanted to right now. But what you could do is the employer matches the 2%. The employers, you know, as I said, they're going to grumble about this, putting more money in, but that's only £30 a month for them. And if the employee was putting in £30 as well, the £1,000 is reached in 17 months. So employers would only be on the hook for £500 spread over 17 months. I'm pretty sure there's a lot of employers could afford that for their staff, particularly if you said, we'll only do this for people earning below a certain salary. And actually, I think that's quite an important thing for companies to do. And you see some of this where they try to give bigger pay rises to the people on lower earnings and things like that, where you try to bring the people at the bottom up more. And I think that's something that we do need to focus on more. The gap between, for example, executive salaries in this country and, you know, the median earner or the lowest earner is absolutely massive. And you regularly read about, you know, this thing about FTSE 100 bosses saying that they're underpaid, even though they're on huge sums of money. It's like, well, maybe you might be, but I tell you what, you need to start paying your lowest paid people more money first, and then we'll worry about whether you should be getting another couple of million because a guy in the US is. So I think that there is that element where you run the risk of people opting out, but the evidence shows that people don't opt out, but you would want to avoid a sudden big jump. So, you know, 2% extra in from you, 2% in from your employer until you've hit the £1,000, then people would probably continue to save that extra 2% into their pension because they're not noticing it. It's been automated. And then you try to nudge them up and nudge them up and nudge them up. And I think also bring in the element of tax relief. You know, you make the contributions from pre-tax earnings and you use the mechanisms that we know are really good for helping people to save for retirement, and then you target it at some other stuff as well.
Lee, just more generally for everyone, should we have a policy where we can borrow from our pension pots up to 20%, let's say, for a house or a, you know, anyone?
I think it starts getting a little bit messy, doesn't it, George? I mean, we look at something like the lifetime ISA, which it muddied the waters between saving for retirement and saving for a property, two wholly different goals, trying to package into one neat ISA, which is just, you know, we've grumbled about it in the past. It's difficult because if you're going to tap up too much of that pension and then have a poorer retirement because of it, it's kind of hard. I think it opens up a real can of worms in terms of how it's being taxed and then how you withdraw it. You know, already we're looking at that big pension, you know, the amount that you can take out age 55, it's going to rise to 57 soonish, whether that's going to be changing the goalposts. I think it starts getting messy. I understand the logic. There are sort of life events in which it is important to be able to get a deposit together for a home if you want to become a home buyer. And if you have managed to auto-roll into a pension and you've built up quite a nice pot, but then you're going to lose out on the kind of compounding effect on that. You're going to have to probably start relatively again from scratch. It's for me a completely different thing. And I personally, my viewpoint is that it's not necessarily a very good idea.
And I agree on that, and I agree on the lifetime ISA, which I always have thought is a bit of a half-baked idea. It had the aura of a George Osborne back of a fag packet policy, but it had a noble aim, but it also took that saving out of the pension system and put it into this new system that isn't an ISA because you can't access the money until you're, you know, 55, or is it 60? It's actually 60 for a lifetime, 60. Right? It's actually more restrictive than the pension, or unless you are, you know, a first-time buyer. So it's not really an ISA. It's called an ISA, but it's not really an ISA. But people were encouraged to be saving for retirement with it as well. What I think is better about, for example, the Schroeder scheme, which is one I wrote about, so that's why I'm talking about it, is that they said that you would be able to get money out for a deposit for a first home, but only from the funds of contributions above the auto-enrollment amount. So you save into your lifetime savings plan, your 8% from auto-enrollment, that's only going to your pension. You cannot use that for your home, but the money you save over and above that and the growth that you get from that, that you can then use for your first home. So I think that's an interesting concept, and it also takes it and it puts it in the same place. And the other big concern about the lifetime ISA, of course, is that if you're saving into a lifetime ISA instead of saving into your work pension, you're potentially missing out on your employer's contributions, mm-hmm. which are one of the most valuable things you can have in your pension. And actually, the other thing to remind people of is when we talk about this quite a bit, when we talk about pensions at work, it's like your work has an auto-enrollment scheme, but it also probably has a different pension scheme or might have a different pension scheme, and that might be more generous. And you're not automatically put into that better one. You might have to opt into your work's better one, and you could find that you put in the same amount of money, but your work matches it instead of putting in 3%. So if you have a work pension and if you've started with your employer and you're listening to this and you're thinking, hang on a minute, am I in the right one? Go check, because it might do you a massive favour.
I've got a big beef with the lighter, as you know. It cost me thousands of pounds. I used it for what it was for, because when I opened it 7 years ago and I was younger, I was like, yeah, maybe I'll get a first-time home with just myself. But no, then I, you know, life happens and I got older and I met someone with kids and I had to get a bigger house. And therefore, the government has decided that even though I did use it for my first-time home, I had to be penalised for it. So I have a big beef with the LISA.
Actually, just as we were talking about the lifetime ISA, I'm sort of racing towards the end of the age group that's able to open one, and I'm starting to wonder now if it's worth me opening one as a supplement to my retirement income. You've got me thinking, Georgia. I've always like blasted it as a kind of as a plan to, you know, I already own a home, so I never thought about it for saving for a home. But now I'm right on that cusp. That's the shortest amount of time for me to actually be able to then access the cash.
I'm not allowed to.
Next, but I'm having a think.
I'm not a financial advisor, and I'm not allowed to give you personal financial advice, Lee, but I think you should definitely put the money into your pension instead, mate.
Maxing out the pension. It's maxed out. I could be getting a 25% uplift. I'm gonna speak to a financial advisor and get their viewpoint.
Right, give us the answer next week.
Okay.
But yeah, but if you are thinking about using it for home, just be aware of that. Right. Moving on. New tipping laws came into force last week, meaning 100% of tips must be given to staff monthly without deductions. Fair enough, you might think. So where will your tips go now? And what is a tronc? Interesting question, because I don't think any of us here knew what a tronc was. But tell us about the bill and why it was brought in.
Yeah, so there's new tipping laws that came in at the start of the month. Basically, do you remember there was quite a lot of grumbling around, especially some really big household names, mm-hmm. restaurant chains and things, in which tips just weren't going to staff, and instead they were just kind of getting hoovered into restaurants and, you know, big hospitality groups, bottom line. Not good. And, you know, a lot of us would have worked in hospitality at some point. I actually think that working in hospitality is a good grounding for the rest of your life, because there are some days when I worked in hospitality as an 18, 19, 20 year old that were some of the toughest working days of my life. You know, up on your feet all day. You know, I sometimes think back, oh, at least this day hasn't been as stressful as that day that I had to manage a load of Chelsea fans solo in a Richmond bar when they were playing in the Champions League. You know, stuff like that. You know, it's a real good grounding. So the new rules are to basically ensure that these tips are given to employees monthly. So, mm-hmm. you know, and there's meant to be more transparency. So if you work for a hospitality industry, doesn't matter how big or small, if you're in a cafe, a restaurant, a bakery, wherever you are, anywhere that, where tips are given, staff have a right to see their employer's tipping policy and records on how many tips were given by punters. So you can actually see this. These days, things have changed quite a lot. You know, we go on about contactless payments and paying by card and all that kind of thing. So it's kind of estimated that 4 in 5 tips are now done by card. And by doing so, the argument is it's become easier for bosses to keep the cash, because it just kind of goes into a computerized system and you can't kind of see what's going on. Now, we should also, on the flip side of this, it could open up a real can of worms for tribunals. There might be some employers out there kind of a little bit worried about what this means, because basically staff would be able to try and get compensation for any breaches. But the government says that an extra £200 million will be taken home by millions of workers as a result of these changes. You know, these changes come in just ahead of probably prime tipping season, which is Christmas, coming up to Christmas. Many more people get a bit more generous. And it is ruddy hard work. People like to tip on merit if they've had a good service. And they want to make sure, it's one of those questions, isn't it? And I've definitely said this to the past, and I'm sure you guys have as well. You know, you go to tip someone and you don't have any change. You don't have any physical cash in your wallet or purse. And you say, this tip is definitely going to you. Like, you'll definitely see the benefit of this tip. You know, and it's quite awkward, isn't it? It's quite an awkward thing to have to ask to make sure that the money that you're adding onto this bill is going to the right person, the person who's actually served you and given you a good service with a smile and, you know, done everything that you wanted them to do. So that should stop all of that. That's what the kind of rules are there for. I think things have got better anyway. I think a lot of employers realised that there's a lot more visibility around this topic, but there's probably plenty of people in the hospitality industry who, you know, bemoan the way that this is done.
I'd say one of the best paid jobs I ever did was working at Henry J. Beans in Bristol when I was a student, because the tips were, honestly, I don't know if I was just really good. I think I was really good, or everyone was really drunk. But it was like an American bar sort of thing. Even my manager on shift would always go, really? How much? Let me double check how many tips you've got. But I always used to think the person who's working the hardest is not me, is the people who are cooking or collecting glasses or all those sorts of things. So does it go into sometimes it goes into a pot for the rest of the staff? I mean, what happens there? Is it just the people who are serving have to get the tip? How will this literally work?
The problem is with these rules is that they are great in terms of saying that all the tips have to go to the staff, but what they haven't done is been prescriptive on how those tips should be shared out. and so on. So there's still a lot of murkiness and grey areas behind this, okay? But what it means is that they can't go to the business. But what I think you need to me to explain now is trunk, isn't it? What is a trunk? And more to the point,
great question.
What is a trunk master?
I mean, just trunk would do, because I don't know what that is, but like a trunk master.
So trunk is something that operates in the hospitality system. And as you said, not many people know about this. Now, funnily enough, I did know about this because my brother-in-law is a head chef. And so he has worked in the hospitality industry for many, many years and is involved in this kind of stuff. And I remember him telling me about it some years ago. And my first question when he told me about it is like, what the hell's a trunk? Trunk is a system that is used to basically smooth out wages in the hospitality sector. So effectively, they can keep a bit of the tips back in order to then top up wages in the quieter months. So if you think about it, there's busy months for hospitality, obviously the Christmas period, et cetera, et cetera. But what they need is they need people to want to work throughout the year. They need staff who want to work in February as well as in December when the tips are good. And they need the staff who do work all throughout the year to be rewarded fairly and not just the extra seasonal workers that get brought in at Christmas or in the summer peak and things like that. So trunk system works like that. And it's used to supplement the wages of salaried employees. And if you leave a cash tip on the night, that will normally go to the waiter or the waitress. On the card, it'll go into the trunk. The trunk is kept and held separately from the restaurant's revenue, and staff generally get a share of it. Again, how that's divided up is up to the individual restaurant, organization, hospitality business, etc. A staff member or potentially a third party company will manage it as the trunk master. That's what a trunk master is. And the cash is then distributed amongst employees. Now, it could also go towards other things. You know, it can be used to cover staff parties, breakages, you know, paying the third party trunk master and those things. But what's going to change here is within the rules, it says that these tips have to be paid out to people within the next calendar month. So it's going to be very hard to smooth out earnings in the same way that they have been smoothed out in the past. And trunk has become such a thing that some people will get jobs where they get guaranteed trunk, or also it's become a thing where sometimes more of the trunk is going to the higher paid members of staff. So they're actually kind of topping up the manager's wages with it and things like that. And it's a little bit opaque. Now, that what the new rules will open up is it will make it much more transparent, because people will be able to find out what the tips were, when they were given and where they went. And B, it will mean that they have to be given out much sooner. So there will be winners from this and there will be losers. But it does kind of upset the apple cart slightly in a way that a system has worked. But I must admit, I changed my behavior due to the new rules. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we went out for dinner on Tuesday night. It's my daughter's birthday. We went to Pizza Express. Breaking the habit of a lifetime, I must say, because normally I'm a strictly independent pizzeria person. Mm-hmm. My daughter wanted dough balls. And also, on top of that, you know those one-for-all gift cards that you get where you can spend them about like gazillion different places? I found one in my desk drawer the other day, and it was from a mobile phone contract where you got effectively £50 cash back by them giving you one of these cards with £50 on it. And I then put it in the drawer and left it there. And I left it there for so long that it now only had £41 something on it. Because with these things, if you don't spend it within a certain amount of time, they start taking 90p a month off you. Cheeky, hey? But you could spend this at Pizza Express. So I was like, well, look, there's an opportunity to spend some of this money, get a bit of money off the dinner and so on. So we went to Pizza Express, got the bill. I looked at it. I just automatically presumed a service charge was going to be on it. There was no service charge on it. They only apply a service charge to parties of something like, I'm going to say it was 7 or more, right? Because I think it was a weird number, not 6, but I might be wrong here. And I was like, oh. So then when I got it and it said, do you want to add a service charge? When I was paying by my card, I added a service charge on my card because I thought, well, do you know what? The staff who've served me this evening are guaranteed to get all of that money. I know none of that money is going to Pizza Express and its owners, Previously, I would have, if there hadn't have been the automatically added on, I wouldn't have added it on the card in a big chain business like Pizza Express, because I would have gone, well, I know where that's going, and it's not to the people who served me, or not all of my money. And I would have rooted around and tried to find some cash somewhere, which generally involves getting my wife to give me some cash, because I never have any cash. But yeah, I changed my behavior because of it. So, but there is an argument, actually, potentially these new rules might lead to less of the, you know, service charge being added to the bill thing, because businesses won't have the incentive to do it anymore, but might then lead to prices rising. But I think a really good comment on this, on the article, came from one of our readers. For goodness sake, stop messing about. Put the right price on the menu and do away with tipping once and for all. Then we will all know what's what and can decide whether we want to visit the restaurant or not. The best tips for restaurants are repeat visits from customers when they've been happy with what they got on previous visits. And I think that's true, especially the bit at the end. The best tip is a repeat visit. Yeah. And I much prefer the French system, service compris, where basically you don't tip. Everything's included in the bill. You know, you don't tip. The habit is that you don't tip, and you might only tip for exceptional service. And even then, they look at you a bit strange when you give them some money.
Yeah. So this is what annoys me. It's like two things. Is one, I don't really understand this trunk thing. You've explained it to me very well. So, but it's just like, just pay your staff fairly throughout the year. They shouldn't be relying on tips. Tips should be if you've had brilliant service. Bring back the idea of if you get great service, you tip them. But otherwise, you know that person serving you, that person cooking the meal, that person whatever, is getting fairly paid. And like Simon said, or whoever said there, the greatest tip is a return visit.
Yeah, I agree, Georgie. And actually, not to bleat on too much more about this, but there's some, you called me optional service charger hater. The 12.5% that's been lumped onto bills in the last decade or so, in lots of places, it drives me around the twist a little bit, because if you want to take that off, it's always that awkward, I don't want to pay that 12.5% optional service charge because the service hasn't been good, etc. And I have done it in the past, and it's never not awkward. It's just not right. It's a real Americanization of our culture, as you say. And I've had it numerous times. You go to a bar and you order a drink, and then someone goes and pours you a beer and then puts it on there, and they charge you optional service charge on it. And you're like, you haven't even brought the drinks over to the table. Things like that are just absolutely maddening. But I'll give you a recent example. So I wrote this column a couple of weeks back about how it was starting to drive me a bit nuts. I went into my favourite local cafe. It's just around the corner to me here. Really like it. Hadn't been in for a month or so. And they changed all their payment systems. So instead of someone coming over with a card machine to take payment, you had to go inside. You can either eat outside or inside the cafe. I usually eat outside because it's got halogen heaters and it's just a more pleasant experience. You had to go inside to go and pay. That's fine. Can deal with that. They swung round one of those tablet style payment devices, and it came up with 20% tip and how much that was going to be with a green smiley face. It had 15% tip with a little yellow kind of like straight line face and how much 15% was. Then there was a 10% button with a red sad face and how much the tip was going to be. And then buried in the very corner, little tiny thing, was no tip. I mean, that is just like, and that is kind of been turned around, and people can see what you're doing in the restaurant, you know, in the cafe. And it's like hitting that no tip button, it gives you a little pang of guilt. You're kind of like, oh, I don't know. But then I hit no tip. I used to just like putting a couple of quid in there. It had a jar that I'd usually just go in, you know, go to the bathroom, put a couple of quid in the jar when I'm leaving. That jar gone. So there was no more cash tips. Jar anymore, just stripped away. But then I walked off, having hit no tip, wondering if, you know, the staff knew, you know, if I was going to be ostracized, if there were people in the cafe think, God, you tight person.
Klaxon alert going.
Yeah, exactly. Like, this guy's not tipping. Which I've got a story about that in a set for you as well. But it's like a klaxon going off. But then I walked out and I was like, actually, that kind of system just belongs in like a primary school classroom. You know, green face if you've done something good, red face if you need some time out, not in a professional business. And it just left me feeling like, you know, I'll still go back to that cafe. Of course I will. I like it. And the service is always pretty good and I'm happy to tip. But I hate that kind of like, it's almost like that kind of nudge economics of like, press this button to give a tip.
Exactly what that is, Lee.
It's happening everywhere. I mean, even in like a supermarket. I went to M&S. Bought something for a couple of quid. It was like £2. I think it was £2.50. Do you want to round this up for £3 for charity? Look, I love charity. I give money to charity every year of my own choosing. Don't ask me at a machine to start rounding up in the back of a end of a cost of living crisis where everything's gone up a load. That's adding, you know, like 20-odd% onto my bill. So madness. But the tipping story, I'll end it all on. I was in America. Obviously the absolute epicenter of tipping, and we just landed in New York, went for this really nice meal, this is my now wife and I, nice meal just outside the High Line. I can remember it all, really lovely. Paid the bill, I'd left my coat inside. It was snowing in New York, it was really, really cold. I'd left my coat in there. I went back and this the waitress was moaning about me, you know, the British always coming in here, never tipping, all this, that and the other. And I obviously overheard all of this because I've gone back in to get my coat, and I was really apologetic. I was like, really sorry. I've just landed from London. It's my first time in New York. I've got absolutely no idea about the tipping rules. Like, you tell me what it is I'm meant to have done. And then I ended up obviously giving the tip. But, you know, that's a different, it's a different thing. That's their culture. That's what they do out there. I just don't really want that culture over here. We just give tips on merit if you feel like you want to give them a tip. You know, there is a minimum wage here. You know, there's some states in the US where wages are incredibly low and the bulk of what hospitality staff is getting is in tips. It's a different thing. It's a different system. It's just really crept up over here. And it should not be that an optional service charge is so awkward to get rid of. And it should not be that we get guilt tripped by machines into leaving a tip. I think it's absolutely outrageous.
So you're a better man than me, though, Lee. If I came back and found someone bitching about me, I'd be like, first of all, the person you need to bitch about is your boss for not paying you fairly. And two, this is exactly the reason why I didn't want to tip you, because you got that sort of vibe. No? Well, fair. That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Alex Webbone of Charles Stanley for our weekly Investing Explained feature. Alex, got a tax question for you this week. If I give money away to my adult children to reduce my inheritance tax liability under the 7-year rule, how can I prove how and when I made the gift?
On your death, your executors will be required to complete an HMRC form called the IHT 403, which will ask questions about any gifts made within the last 7 years. If this is the case, the executors will be expected to provide a description of what you've given to whom and when. So the answer in a nutshell is to keep detailed records. Write it down, print off bank statements or confirmation of the transfer. If you work with a financial advisor, you can ask them to provide you with a letter confirming the gift, the details, its purpose in the estate planning. But ultimately, you want to make it as easy as possible for those once you've died, and keeping detailed records is the easiest way to do that.
So there's two prongs to that, isn't there? There's the executor knowing that you've made the gifts, but then also potentially the evidence that needs to be shown to HMRC to show that you did actually give that money away on that date.
Exactly. So the executors will hopefully have an idea of what your estate planning looked like before you died, so it doesn't come as a surprise to them. And yes, if it's the case that they didn't know, keeping detailed records is the easiest way for them to understand your intentions once you've died.
Alex, thank you very much.
Thanks, Simon.
Welcome back. Right, reader question time. It's all about mortgages. So, reader owns a home valued at £450,000 with about £150,000 left to pay off the mortgage. But they've got their eye on a bigger one listed for £650,000. So, went to the estate agent. Estate agent said they could get a 10% discount if they paid with cash and they didn't have a chain. So, this is the reader question. My parents would be able to stump up the £600,000, which is what it would be with the discount. Our idea is to then give them the £300,000 or so from our former home when that's sold, and then pay them back the remaining £300,000 in the form of a sort of Bank of Mum and Dad interest-free mortgage. Now, they're happy to have it repaid over 20 years, so that works out £1,250 per month, and we're happy to have all the documentation drawn up to commit to these terms. Now, it sounds ideal on paper, they're circumnavigating the bank, saving on interest. So, Simon, are they missing something?
No, I mean, you know, cash buyer is a cash buyer. People like cash buyers because it's more likely to guarantee that the sale is going to go through. And if they are keen on getting the sale done, getting it done quickly and avoiding any hurdles, potentially involving a mortgage lender downvaluing the property, a mortgage lender not being willing to lend the buyers as much money as they originally thought they were going to get, or any of the other hiccups that can occur, then a cash buyer can be very attractive. Estate agents will often interestingly define people to sellers as a cash buyer who may actually need a mortgage. I was speaking to someone about this recently who said that had happened to them. And they were like, we never said we were cash buyers. So often an estate agent will say, oh, they're a cash buyer, meaning that they've already agreed to sell their property or that they've got the money in the bank, but they still need a mortgage, but they don't need to sell their property. So in theory, the cash buyer thing and the willingness to give a discount is absolutely fine. The parental loan thing is slightly trickier, and it comes back to that age-old adage about the inheritance tax thing, and the inheritance tax being a tax paid by people who don't trust their relatives, right? Or the estates of people who don't trust their relatives. Now, if there is an absolute, you know, total trust and agreement between the person involved, the person's partner involved, and the parents lending the money, and everyone is 100% clear on what is happening and what happens in the event of a relationship breakup, you know, how's that going to work? How is the property going to be owned? Are you willing to sign a declaration of trust that says the first X amount goes to this person, the next X amount goes to that person, and get it all done properly? Then it can be totally fine. There is also, you know, the question of whether the parents then register an interest in the property, you know, which would mean that if the property was sold, they'd have a charge on it. They'd need to be paid back. That's effectively what a mortgage lender does. But you've got to be aware that if you do give someone a charge on your property, you're not going to find a mortgage lender or most mainstream mortgage lenders who are then going to lend to you. They want to be first charged on that property and nobody else. And there are also inheritance tax elements at play here where, you know, if the person who gives the money survives for another 7 years, that's absolutely fine. If they give the money and they don't survive for another 7 years, then there might be an inheritance tax implication. Now, in this case, they're talking about paying the money back without a rate of interest. So, you know, there's not a benefit there, but you need to look into this stuff properly before you do something like this, rather than just going into it with a, you know, oh yeah, great, let's just do it and it'll be fine attitude, because that's where things can potentially crop up down the line that you haven't thought of or you haven't agreed about, and then you cause yourself a problem.
So in sum, doable.
In sum, if you can do it, great. I mean, literally talk about the bank of mum and dad. The bank of mum and dad are literally your mortgage lender. In theory, everyone's a winner here, but you need to think about the situations where everyone's a winner and then someone turns into a loser, and what you're going to do then so that you don't end up with that problem down the line. Because if the relationship does break up, then the potential for it to get acrimonious very fast is definitely there.
Yeah, indeed. Lee, meanwhile, sticking with mortgages, we are told by the experts that they're expecting mortgage rates to rise again and very soon. Why?
Well, we've just come off the back of a few months of major lenders really repricing home loans in a downward trajectory. So there's been, you know, much better mortgage rates available out there. But that tide seems to be stopping somewhat. But this is not a cause for absolute panic. This is not mortgage rates are shooting up, you know, Truss mini-bond-esque style, mini-budget-esque style. This is a kind of more of a pausing, it looks like, of what's been the recent trend. So this week we've had Coventry Building Society, a big lender, and Co-op too. They've repriced some of their mortgage deals higher. The whole reason why experts are saying that we might be now seeing rates maybe trick a little bit higher, or maybe just saying a little bit like plateaued a little bit for now, it's basically the way that banks price in their lending is largely done with SONIA swap rates. So swap rates basically look at the way that where fixed rates are going to be heading, because it's where banks kind of turn to get their funding. So essentially, earlier in the week, a two-year swap rate was at 4.07%, and five-year swap was at 3.81%. Actually, on the 20th of September, so only a few weeks back before that, two-year swap was at 3.82%, and five-year swap was at 3.52%. So that's a fairly high nudge upwards. The reason for all of that is David Hollingworth of L&C Mortgages here saying, you know, fixed rate pricing depends on what market anticipates may happen to interest rates, and uncertainty over the forthcoming budget, mixed messages from the Bank of England, and global unrest is pushing costs back up for lenders. Swap rates are a good indicator of direction of fixed rate pricing, as they have bounced back up. If that persists, fixed rate improvements will be brought to an abrupt halt and edge back up. So it seems that it looks like some of the major lenders, you wouldn't be surprised to see in the next week or two, nudging a bit higher, but nothing supersonic. Nothing, you know, when we're going to be sort of doing an upward line of mortgage rates are going rocketing.
No, right, good.
Of, you know, more like a gentle nudge at the moment, unless things change. But we'll be keeping a firm eye on swap rates.
All right. Lee, time for Collection Corner. You have for us this week a really expensive Pokemon card, a rare 50p coin, and not one, but six NatWest 1980s ceramic piggy banks. What's all this about, Lee?
Where to start, George? Is this?
I know.
Moment. Well, you know, I'm into the kind of collecting stuff, the collectibles, and, you know, kind of modern classic stuff that's out there. So I'll start with the Pokemon card. Now, I'm going to be completely honest with you here. I was never really into Pokemon. It really is my era, you know, late 90s, but it just was never for me. But some of those late 90s cards, packs, go for absolute huge money now if they're in very good condition. I've taken more of an interest in it in the last 6 to 9 months, mainly because my nephew has massively got into it. So he's forever showing me his expanding collection of rare cards. And actually for his birthday a couple of weeks ago, went to this fantastic shop in Romford. It was called Retro Giant. Give them a shout out, a little local business there. And they were selling packs of Pokemon cards from the first editions in a kind of like mystery pack. So I bought him a mystery pack of 10 cards. And he opened it on his birthday, and he said that was the best present he had. He got some really cool stuff in there, and he said this one card, he's like, this is worth £70. I was like, it can't be worth £70. But then he's showing me all on eBay, and he's doing all these filters and all this kind of stuff, and he's showing me, and actually, no, he was right. They were sold prices for sort of around that amount of money. He knows his stuff. And so this Pokemon card is one of only 39. It's called the Pokemon Illustrator card. It was bought really largely to fame by Logan Paul, YouTube star. Don't look at me with puzzled looks if you've got no idea who I'm talking about. He paid £3.97 million for one in April 2022. It would have been a bit of a kind of like stunt for YouTube and all of that kind of thing. But this card is going up at a French auction, and it is said to probably be sold for about €300,000, so £250,000. Don't be surprised if it goes for more than that, because that is an ultra rare card. But it's becoming quite a sort of alternative asset class, I would argue. You know, lots of these things are graded now. Lots of the cards in good condition are disappearing, and it's adding to the intrigue. So if you've got an old Pokemon collection, you know what to do. Go and dig them out. Send them in to editor@thisismoney.co.uk, and we can get our expert valuer, Dan Hatfield, to run the rule over them for our Modern Treasures series. Next up, have you got a salmon 50p coin swimming around
any 50p
somewhere.
Coins, Lee. I don't have a lot of
You've not got
cash.
Any of them swimming around your house, because if you not. Do, this is big news, Georgie. This is big news in the coin world. Say the Kew Gardens 50p. You know all about the Kew Gardens 50p, right? There were 210,000 of them minted in 2009. An incredibly low run of coins. What happened from that point onwards is that collectors cottoned on, and it has ramped up the price ever since. So to get one of those Kew Gardens 50p coins, circulating version, I should add, you're going to be paying north of 100 quid for a 50p coin if you want it in your collection. But this week we had the news from the Royal Mint that there's a coin, 50p coin, is even rarer than that Kew Gardens ride, and it's caused a bit of a splash, if you pardon the pun. The 50p salmon coin, which is part of this King Charles sort of designed collection of kind of wildlife coins that came out. There's only 200,000 of them minted in 2023, Georgie. That is an incredibly low amount. And they're selling now. We were watching eBay auctions this week. Helen Crown and I, sorry, Helen, for making you do that. But they were selling, you know, 60, 70, 80 quid, where people were cottoning on again that this coin now is super rare. We tracked this eBay auction. There was 10 of these coins in a sealed bag. And I think the last we looked at it, it was selling, the bids on it were over $2,000 for 10 of these coins. So incredibly rare coin. Have a real check around, because there is a big possibility that you've had one of those in your change this year. That's one of those where it's like, actually, you could have that. The Kew Gardens coin, you would know by now, like, it's very likely that they've all been hoovered out of circulation. The salmon 50p, there will be those coins still floating around, coming into your change in those piggy banks. Honestly, have a look at how much they're selling for on eBay and go for it. And the last and but not least, so I plugged Dan Hatfield's column earlier. He does a bi-weekly column for us called Modern Treasures, where he's valuing readers and listeners' items from sort of post-war. So you know, essentially the nostalgic items that you might have knocking around or something you've got an interest in. This one was 6 NatWest piggy banks. So in the 1980s, NatWest handed out piggy banks to children, ceramic piggy banks. I don't think I can call them cute. I think they're kind of a bit frightening.
They're
a bit menacing. But this person paid £25 at an auction for them. 6 pigs, so 5 are part of the collection, and then there's a spare one. They've still got the stoppers, which the bit that obviously keeps the money in at the bottom. You've got Woody, Annabelle, Maxwell, Lady Hillary, and Sir Nathaniel Westminster. And basically, as you save more money, you've got the next piggy bank up. So the later piggy bank, the Nathaniel, was the rarest, because not everyone got to that savings part where they got that piggy bank. Very, very nostalgic 1980s thing, but it was very popular, very popular. They made over 1 million of these, a company called Wade. Absolutely phenomenally popular. And then obviously went out of popularity. But how nice would it be if a bank now just came out of a limited edition ceramic piggy bank? I think people would go for it. I think it would be a really good thing to do in a world in which we're just constantly on screens and mucking around. And just going back to my nephew enjoying Pokemon, he likes holding the physical asset, the thing in his hand. Remember, a physical piggy bank that's a kind of special edition. That NatWest, you know what to do. Just give me a call and we'll make it happen. Yeah. So basically, asking if this £25 purchase was any good. Dan says that basically, if you sell them all together, £50 to £70. If you sold them individually, you're probably looking at more like £110, mainly because Sir Nathaniel can go for 30 to 50 quid. He's the most expensive one, as I said earlier. Now, the bonus bit of this, and the real kind of holy grail of the NatWest piggy bank collecting, which is a sentence I was not expecting to be saying on this podcast, is a Cousin Wesley. Now, Cousin Wesley was introduced in 1998. He was a bit of a later pig, but he was quite unpopular. Not many people actually got him, and he is incredibly rare. If you have got a Cousin Wesley piggy bank, 150 quid. They are super rare. So he is worth more than all of the pigs put together. So I'll give Dan one more plug. If you do have some items that you want to have valued, just send us all of the details, pictures, information where you got it, why you think it might be worth a bit of cash, over to editor@thisismoney.co.uk with the subject line modern treasure.
Lovely. Thank you very much, Lee. Right, Simon, all that's left is for your stat of the week. I feel like we should have a tune or something, you know, but never mind.
Stat of the week.
I mean, that'll do, Lee. I'm just going to copy that and just reuse it every week. Simon, have we got a stat?
I'm glad he stepped in before I was tempted to start humming my own made-up stat of the week tune. Okay, right. We talked at the front of the podcast about the need for financial resilience. But what about the other end? What does it take to be in the top 10% of households by income in the UK? So this is household income. Overall, could be from one person, could be from two people, could be from wages and salaries, self-employment, private pensions, investment income, etc.
100,000?
Higher. 152,815 pounds, according to the most recent statistics from the Office of National Statistics that ran up to 2022-2023. But how much are those households paying in tax each year? 60,344 pounds.
Wow. Would be
the average total tax take from those top 10% households. Now, obviously, that's across the top 10%, because the top 1%, if you look at the data on this, there's a hockey stick thing that even happens right at the top. But there you go. If your household income is £152,815 or more, you are in the top 10%, and you're probably paying at least £60,000, £344 a year in tax.
Lovely. That's it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon,
you can email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk, tweet us @thisismoney, or come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past and join in the debate in reader comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.